Welcome everyone to TupaCast episode 5. I'm your host Christopher, and with me is my co-host Matthew. Okay, so tonight we're going to talk about Captain EO. We'll throw in some Michael Jackson and some Disney World memories. Disney World's the one in Florida, right?
I believe so.
Always get them mixed up. Okay, so Captain EO, your thoughts? Do you want to kind of... Well, I guess my notes are in order of the show. You want to... I guess you want to say anything about it?
We can kind of go through the movie. Or, yeah, I guess movie. Some background history, from what I remember, is it was made in... Is it the early 80s? Correct me at any point when I'm wrong.
Okay.
It was made in the early 80s, and it was directed by Francis Ford Coppola, and it was produced by Francis Ford Coppola, some other guy, and George Lucas.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is kind of, you know, the big surprise. It's 20 minutes long, and it costs $30 million. So I don't know if it still holds the record, but for the longest time, it held the actual official record for being the most expensive per minute film production.
Yeah, I read that today too. I was like, man, that's $30 million. That's crazy. Well, on YouTube, it was 18 minutes, so I don't know if they shortened it or not, but man, that wow.
Yeah, it's like I don't see where it all went. I mean, it's really impressive. And I'm, you know, we'll go through in a second, but it's really impressive. But
well, on Wikipedia, it said that the expense went to the 3D 70 millimeter film. I guess it was a really expensive film to use.
Oh, okay. Because, yeah, it was 3D.
Yes. Yeah, watching it on YouTube, you can tell, like, it doesn't really, I'm not saying it looks 3D, but you can tell, like, I guess it's the way they layered it or something. But you can kind of see things kind of floating out, like different lighting and stuff where it would be 3D. It's kind of neat.
I remember when we went to Disney World, this was a big deal because, you know, Michael Jackson, and I probably didn't even know it was by George Lucas. Just it was Michael Jackson sci-fi, and it's 3D, and it's like, oh wow, awesome. And you know, you go into this giant, I guess, theater, and I think we sat. There's a second 3D movie there, which was about like fields and flowers that we had to stand at. But this one we sat, and they give you those like pink purplish 3D glasses,
uh-huh.
And it started and. Only 3D part I remember was the asteroid kind of floats out and up into the crowd, and I remember kind of like reaching for, you know, like everyone.
Oh, sure.
And it gets blown up.
Yeah.
I don't remember any 3D after that, though, except for that flying rat.
Yeah. Hey, didn't we see one in one of the, what is it with the villages from around the world, whatever that was called, where it was in, like, you're in a theater, but it's round, and the movie's, like, playing all around you in a circle. And you stand in the middle of it, so you can look. That thing, that was kind of weird.
Was 3D,
I don't think it was 3D, but it was like, you know, surround. I forgot what they, but it was kind of weird.
Okay, it was one of the international ones, and I remember how they showed a picture of an oil tanker or something. I remember it was neat, but it was kind of a pain because you want to see everything.
Yeah, you didn't know where to look.
Yeah.
Hey, you're talking about Captain EO and George Lucas. According to Wikipedia, George Lucas is the one that came up with the name Captain EO.
What does that stand for?
Oh man, I should have wrote it down. It's Greek for something. I don't remember. New beginning or there you go.
You hear me typing?
Yeah.
Yeah, it would probably help to, you know, bring it up.
Yeah.
So if I remember correctly, based on my studies, Greek studies, Captain EO. EO is actually Greek for dawn.
Dawn, okay, okay.
So, Captain Dawn, which kind of, I guess, plays into the very end of the movie. When I saw it, I guess I'll give my quick review.
Okay.
The special effects are amazing. I would say most of them still stand up today, especially the spaceship, the initial space battle. The sets are amazing. The character costumes are amazing. There's a little bit of kind of that blue screen. Not as bad as, you know, the Rancor in Return of the Jedi.
Oh.
Of course, this was fuzzy and on YouTube, so who knows. But mainly it was with the flying rat thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
it was short. I mean, it was a quick 18 minutes, but I still, you know, while I was watching, I was kind of impressed that Disney would have an 18-minute movie playing, because that's a fair amount of time.
Their rides are so quick, you know, get in, get out, get more people in, more money. But that's a big time investment.
Yeah, They basically, they're, are they supposed to be like an awesome team, or are they're the misfit team?
I think at the beginning it says something about like they're misfits or a ragtag band, because that hologram guy kept making comments about how they keep screwing up their missions. So it's sort of, my impression was they're just sort of like, you know, misfits, I guess.
Okay. So they're misfits, and they're supposed to go to some world and bring peace and love because it's become dark and overclouded, I guess. And, you know, the planet throws up some spaceships, and there's a cool space battle with model ships. They crash land, and then they get captured, don't they?
Yes, they get captured by some, like, Borg-looking... Well, this would be way before the Borg, but people covered in, like, pipes and metal and stuff.
It's a very mechanical planet, very dark and mechanical.
Right, very lifeless.
Whereas, you know, as you'd see in the end, not to spoilers, where Michael Jackson's mission was to bring color and kind of nature. But, yeah, so they get captured. They go in front of the weird but awesome, like, mechanical Borg queen lady, which was Angelica Houston, actually.
Right. You know, that queen design reminded me a lot of, like, the H.R. Geiger stuff.
Yeah.
Like, from the Aliens and stuff. Like, a lot of his artwork. I don't know if they referenced that or not, but that's what I thought of when I saw it. So this was after the Aliens movie, so maybe they were kind of pulling from it a little bit.
Yeah, possibly. And then, so she's basically, he's like, hey, you know, you're a good person, come on, join us or whatever, and she's like, kill him.
Yeah. No, yeah. She said 100 years of torture.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
I was like, this is crazy.
Yeah, that doesn't quite go with Disney. And then she said, turn his shipmates into trash cans or something.
Yeah, because they were robots, I think.
Yeah. That's pretty ruthless.
Yeah. And then kind of leading up to this, when I was watching it, you know, like I really admired Michael Jackson. I mean, that's a whole other podcast right there. But, you know, so it's like, oh, yeah, you know, he has the awesome entrance in the beginning. And, you know, he's the main star, obviously. And you know he's going to do awesome things in the movie, but, you know, he's got such a soft-spoken voice that it was kind of, he didn't fit the role initially.
Right. Yeah, he was like,
you know, he was kind of good.
He's like, let's get him.
Yeah. Hey, guys. I mean, you know, like I said, he's soft-spoken. And,
right.
And you could tell it was a vehicle playing off of his popularity. And so it was like for the first, I don't know, 15 minutes or so, it's kind of painful to watch because it was like, you know, he's not a true great actor. And it was just, it's like, okay, Disney, you're playing off his popularity, and please don't speak, and, you know, all that stuff. And then, he, you know, when the queen starts to attack him, you know, his, I guess, fighting skill was the power of music. And as soon as the music starts and he starts dancing, I mean, within a second, he becomes a totally different person.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
It was just phenomenal to see, you know, this person who, yeah, he shouldn't really even be acting, you know, get him off the screen, all of a sudden, he was doing what he did best, and that part alone is worth watching the whole show for because, you know, his transition was amazing.
Yeah, that's a good point. When he's dancing and singing, man,
he's in his element, and it shows.
Yeah, he really takes charge. You know, before he's kind of like, you know, he's the leader, but they're all screw ups, and he's like, you know, that little elephant guy, Hooter, and he's like, you know, come on, Hooter, stop doing that. You know, and they're just bumbling along, and then all of a sudden he starts dancing and singing. It's like, wait a minute, you know. But okay, I'm gonna talk about Hooter for a minute. Okay, so Hooter is just like Max Rebo from Return of the Jedi. Now I don't know if this came out before Return of the Jedi or after. It's probably after. But he even played the piano, and he was a blue elephant guy. So I don't know if George Lucas was kind of, you know, running out of ideas, or he did that on, well, I guess he had to do it on purpose, but I'm not sure why you would pick a character that close. You know, unless they made this first and then he liked him so much, he said, I'm going to kind of change him up a little bit and put him in Return of the Jedi.
It shows that it opened in 1986, and Return of the Jedi was 83, right?
Oh, okay, so, yeah.
So it's definitely afterwards. I mean, probably liked the concept, and he wanted to, you know, tweak it and use it a little bit. I mean, I, that big of a parallel between them. I guess I was too busy being annoyed at his fart and burp jokes.
Yeah, he's wearing a wife beater and stuff. He was kind of like the slob of the group, you know?
Yeah.
The spaceship at the beginning I thought was pretty cool. Their ship with the fins.
It kind of reminded me of Java's cell barge.
That's exactly what I was going to say. And then when they crash on the planet, it's like an obvious Death Star run.
Yeah.
They go through the canyon and stuff, and it's just like the Death Star. It's kind of weird that, you know, I don't know. I guess they're like George Lucas make it look like Star Wars, but I was like, come on, man. You know, like, I don't know.
Well, I bet you're right. I bet the planet surface Death Star correlation and the sail barge most likely were, you know, they told George Lucas, hey, you know, pull it in with Star Wars, or it was just his own initiative to not link it to Star Wars, but, you know.
Right. Yeah. And then when that their ship's flying in, they even lose their antenna dish, like the Millennium Falcon did when it flew into Death Star. It broke off. And on their ship, the same thing happens. Come on, man. But, I mean, it was fun. And also, the bad guy spaceship looked just like a Klingon bird of prey.
Yeah, I kind of noticed that, too.
So, it was really fun. But looking at it now, it's like every single thing on there was ripped off of something. Aliens or totally Star Wars. Now, whether, you know, it's all on purpose or not, but some of it, you know. One thing I thought was kind of funny was that robot had a mustache.
Did you notice in the beginning when they were going to battle stations, there was like a little vacuum robot and it plugged into the other robot's back?
Yes.
Okay, I wasn't sure if that actually happened, and I feel like rewinding.
Yeah, but they never showed him again. That was kind of a neat thing. They were like a symbiote and a host or something.
Yeah.
And then, the robot with the mustache, that was kind of funny, but kind of like, you know, weird. Then he had a peg leg. And, you know, later the peg leg turns into a guitar, which is cool or whatever. But, you know, it's like, why does he have a peg leg? Why don't they just make him another leg? He's a robot. You know? And then his leg could turn into a guitar. I don't know. It was neat because it's different. But when you start thinking about it, it's like, why does he have a peg leg?
Well, I don't think you're meant to analyze it.
You're not supposed to take notes. Okay, so at the beginning, they're talking to that guy on the hologram, and he's giving them a hard time about how they're screw-ups, and they better not screw it up. But it's interesting because he's like, don't mess up. This is important. You know, don't screw it up like you did the last time. But if it's that important, why would they send them? You know, they saved the whole planet or whatever, but don't screw it up, you know. But anyway.
Right, it was only 17 minutes long, and I looked it up, and it's only 17 minutes. They told a fairly complex story and did actually decent character development in 17 minutes worth of time. So, you know, you got to kind of just roll with it.
I was just writing down everything that came to me. You know, I mean, it's neat that they have this misfits and they save the whole planet. That's a good message for, you know, kids and whatnot and anybody. But the hologram guy, man, he had some huge eyebrows.
Yeah. Well, a lot of it, I think it was meant for kids.
Sure, sure.
And so it's some of the stuff. Well, I mean, obviously Hooter is like losing body functions everywhere. Right then and there, I was like, all right, I'm a little too old for this. I'm not the target audience here.
Yeah, then the other thing too is, you know, back to the big eyebrowed hologram guy. I don't know if it was Hooter or not, but he threw like eggs on him or something. Like and it like stuck, so the hologram couldn't see. That was kind of funny. I always liked Max Rebo. I don't know, Blue Elephant guy. He's always been kind of one of my favorites. So Hooter was kind of neat and goofy. And then then they crash, right? So they're there to save the whole planet, you know. And they're like, "Don't mess up, guys." And you know, they're like, "Come on, guys, we got to pull it together." They crash, and like it looks like a huge trash compactor or something. And then Hooter puts a trash can on his head. And it's like, let's go save the planet. And he's like, no, wait. I got to put this trash can on my head. And then he's like, okay, I'm ready. It's just so funny. I was like, what? And then, of course, then at the end, when Michael saves the queen, the whole planet immediately goes from being metal and junk to trees and rocks. So that was interesting.
Everybody's happy all of a sudden.
Yeah, despite the years and years of torment and torture and everything. It's a very simple message, but I think it's a good message, is that, you know, music, happiness, being happy, you know, those kind of things really can make a difference and change people.
Yes.
You know, I mean, if...
Sure. Hey, did you notice when they were dancing? So, you know, what are our comments on just, you know, how he really just stole the show at that point. But he was an awesome dancer.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Now, I don't know if the people behind him were, like, random people, or if they were not supposed to dance as good as him to make him look good. But what comes across is, when you watch it, he is far and above the best dancer there.
Oh, sure.
You know, I mean, he's definitely got skill. So, I mean, I'm kind of leaning towards the fact that he's just above and beyond really good.
Well, and he was also it was him and another guy that choreographed it. So, you know, I'm sure, you know, if they were better than him, he was like, you know, don't look better than me. But no, he was awesome, and his spacesuit thing was pretty cool looking. He always has that kind of military look, but not like a threatening.
Like a uniform.
Right.
It's more of like a formal military uniform, but.
Yeah, but it was like, you know, I'm a tough guy, but I don't need to use violence or aggression. I can use my music, and he's like soft spoken, so it's sort of like two opposing forces. You know, you have this tough military look, but he's soft spoken and he dances and he sings, and you know, it's kind of neat. It's not threatening at all.
It would be interesting to know why he chose the fashion he did, just in his music career, because it is military, and it's just interesting, you know, because
I've always loved, you know, his style, always loved it. And I remember, like, in school, like, his red Thriller jacket and stuff, everybody had them. And I think there's a black jacket he had too. Maybe they made the Thriller jacket in black, but you know, man, he looked so awesome. He was so cool. And then when you saw like a kid at school wearing it, you're like, oh, he doesn't look so cool.
Yeah.
You know, but when normal people wore it, it wasn't cool. But when Michael Jackson wore it, it's just awesome. It was the same thing with Miami Vice. When everyone started wearing like sports coats and, you know, white pants and stuff to school, it's like, man, you look kind of dorky. But man,
the pastel pink.
Oh yeah.
It's not really cool.
But on a TV show, dang, they were awesome. I remember Mom made me a white sport coat, and I'd roll up the sleeves and wear it to school.
I remember that. Yeah,
I was Crockett.
Lame.
Back to Captain EO. I only noticed two, what's it called, inconsistencies. When he talks to the queen and she says get him, and he runs away and they kind of drop the gate, and then he turns around and then he starts singing. Well, when he runs up to the gate, when he ran up to the gate, his uniform was all buttoned or whatever, and when he turned around and ran back, his uniform was open and like flopping around. You could see his T-shirt under it, or the other way around. I kept being interrupted, so I had to keep stopping it. So I had plenty of time to, you know, write everything down. And then when the robot transformed into a drum set, on one of the scenes, his head was on the other side of the drum set than the other scene. And you know, neither of these are a big deal. But when you have Francis Ford Coppola and George Lucas on this and this much money, you would think. Yeah, you know, and if I picked it up watching it on 2-minute intervals on YouTube, you'd think somebody would, you know, or maybe they saw it after the fact and like, well, there's nothing we can do about it now. You know, they didn't realize, they didn't catch it till afterwards, and it's like, well, we'd have to reshoot the whole thing.
Yeah, well, once they're done, you would think they would catch that in their daily review.
Yeah.
Of the footage shot, but you know, yeah, once they probably don't look at little stuff like that. Because you see stuff like that in all sorts of movies.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the directors must be looking at the big picture. Okay, how's the shadow? How's the lighting?
Right.
Stuff like that. So a lot of little things do get missed.
Sure. Yeah, well, the Star Wars is infamous for that. The Stormtrooper hitting his head and the blue milk. And I think there's some other ones in that first.
What's wrong with the blue milk?
It keeps switching hands.
Oh.
Like from his left to right hand, or the jug keeps moving or something. And I think there's somewhere Chewie's bandoliers on the other side, or Han's belt is on the other side, or something, you know, little things like that, because they, when they come back and do it, they've shifted or moved things.
See, okay, here's what I don't get. And I don't know the whole story, so I mean, I could be way off when I say this, but let's say a bandolier, and again, I don't know if this even happened, but it's kind of indicative of stuff that does occur. Let's say you're chewing, and you know, you're in one scene, the bandolier's on the wrong side. Right. Yes.
Hey, hold up. Dad's calling. I'm going to see if I can get both of you on it. Okay. Dad?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, Dad.
Oh, okay. There we go. Okay, so Dad, we just finished talking about Captain EO, and right now we are in the middle of talking about on movies how little things get changed. For instance, someone's wearing a gun on the left hip, but in the next scene it's on their right hip.
Yeah.
So we're kind of talking about that. Matthew was talking about We're talking about Star Wars, and he's talking about Chewbacca, I think, right?
Yeah, it's like, you know, I don't know if this ever occurred, but like I was telling Christopher, it's indicative of what happens in movies. It's like, okay, so let's say Chewbacca, you know, he's got his bandolier slung one way, and that's the way it's supposed to be, and then in one scene, oh, they switched it, and it's on the other side, and then the rest of the movie, it's on the correct side, right? So my comment was, do you really, as an actor who doesn't speak, have that much to do that you can't get so involved in your role that you
yeah, that's
I mean,
a good.
He doesn't have to do any dialogue.
Right.
He doesn't have to do any dance sequences.
Yeah, and it's not like he's wearing a whole bunch of clothes. It's one thing.
Yeah, and I mean, would you not be so, any actor, be so involved in your role that you would keep track of stuff like that?
Yeah, because, you know, like even, you know, like drawing a comic, you know, you draw something, you draw a person with the uniform or you know, whatever. Kate, you know, like, who's a famous I don't know, Green Lantern, he's got the ring on a certain finger, and you know, it's like in the next panel it's on the wrong finger, you know, they don't do that. You know,
right.
But you know, I, you know, maybe they're just caught up in it in a hurry, I don't know. Sometimes I always used to think they reversed the film, but I guess that doesn't happen. That probably doesn't make any sense.
I think sometimes that happens.
They kind of, yeah, they flop it, and they don't realize that stuff's on the other side.
Yeah, or it's so small, no one will notice.
Let me introduce, hey everybody, my dad, Alton, has called in.
Hello.
So Dad, we talked about Captain EO. Do you remember watching Captain EO at Disney World?
All I remember was it was Michael Jackson 3D, that's it. That was a long time ago.
Yeah, that was, man. We were in what, junior high?
Was it 1988?
Whoa, dang. Was that when we moved to Texas, or we still lived in Indiana?
It was Indiana, because didn't you guys sell the four-wheeler so we could go?
No, I don't think that's what happened. But I don't remember if it was Texas or Indiana. I know y'all weren't, y'all were still pretty young.
Wow, 80, man, that was almost 20 years ago. 20 years ago, geez.
Yeah, and I couldn't watch it. I was trying to watch it today, but great witness product wouldn't. Kept crashing my Explorer, so I couldn't watch it.
Oh.
But anyway, you were talking about movies that, where they don't do things like that. I was watching one, within the past month. It was a Western movie, and I don't remember the name of the movie, but somebody got into a Jeep. A guy got into a Jeep, I guess an open-top Jeep, and he
Wait, this is a Western?
No, it wasn't a Western.
Oh. Yeah. It was a time-traveling Western.
Yeah. They got into a Jeep, took a lever-action rifle from somebody, threw it in a Jeep, was driving down the road, and then they stopped to get in, to go some, stop, and then they confronted some other people. So he jumped out of the Jeep with a double-barrel shotgun.
That's a huge man. How do they make that kind of
double-barrel shotgun in his Jeep all along? But I mean, you know, it didn't make sense.
Oh, and they just never showed it.
Well, yeah, I don't know, but I mean, you know, you physically saw him take a lever, throw it in the back of the Jeep, drive, reach for a gun back of the Jeep, and it's double-barrel shotgun.
It's like you never know what you're gonna find in the back of a Jeep.
On some of the TV shows too, we've caught them like the CSI show. They'll come up to a crime scene, and the gloves is one you notice a lot. They'll have their plastic gloves on, and then the next scene you know, they're still there at the crime scene. It's like, you know, 30 seconds later, and they don't have the gloves on. Or they, you know, they start with them, and then they don't have them, or they don't have them, they do. You know, they get the gloves thing wrong.
It just seems so weird to me that there's so many people working on a movie or a TV show that they wouldn't, somebody wouldn't say, hey, wait, put your gloves on. You know, there's, I mean, it's not just the actors and a camera guy. There's like 20 people standing around. Somebody should notice that. I don't know.
Here's one of the things I always thought was interesting. You know, a lot goes into movies, complex stunts, all that, you know, to film a scene. But they'll film all day and get like 4 minutes worth of footage.
Yeah.
And I understand you film a lot. You know, you film multiple scenes to get the right one. But really, guys, all day, 4 minutes?
Yeah, that would drive me crazy.
Is it just that they're kind of like, we worked 4 hours and now the actors need a break? Or is it really take that amount of time?
Well, I don't know. I've heard of them doing like 50, 60 takes on a scene. So I guess it could take, I don't know if I could do a scene 50 or 60 times, much less film it or, you know, be the director. I'd be like, all right, come on.
Yeah.
You got 3 tries.
Well, there was some of these movies, you know, you've seen them before, where they show you how they did the movies. And there was this one where they had a scene out in the jungle. I don't know if it was a Schwarzenegger movie, but it was some jungle scene, and good guys and the bad guys, and the guy stole a motorcycle, and then he was riding around, and then other guys came in, they were shooting at each other, and then he was being chased by a helicopter, and he drove real fast, and he drove up on a ramp, and he shot up over the building, and then he's going over the building, and the building blows up.
Oh, that's Triple X.
Okay, and you know, you get one shot at that.
Yeah.
That I can see, it might take them a week to prepare for that, because they have to get the stunts right. They got to practice. You know, they got to practice somewhere. They got to get all the charges set up right. They probably practice that somewhere. And then they probably have 40 cameras filming that thing.
Yeah.
And they just get, you get one chance to do it. And hopefully when the guy jumps over the building, it's done right.
Yeah, I remember.
He could change the movie and he's dead.
Yeah. I remember watching that same thing you're talking about. I was like, man, the prep work that must go into something like that, and coordinating all the people, you know, that are on the motorcycles and the jeeps and stuff, so they don't hit each other, and timing everything. Man, that's a lot of pressure, because if something goes wrong, you know, people's lives are at stake. You know, mm-hmm. You could run into somebody or get run over a charge and get blown up or set on fire or something. Speaking of making movies and stuff, I was watching, have you guys seen 30 Days of Night?
No.
It's a vampire movie set in Alaska, and they filmed it, I was watching the commentary a little bit last night, and they filmed it in New Zealand. And so in the movie, there's like this little town, and it's in Alaska, it's in the middle of nowhere, it's covered in snow, you know. Well, in New Zealand, they built a town for the movie. They didn't like go find a town. They built one, and it's not real snow. There's no snow. So they made fake snow out of like paper and like baking powder and something else. I can't remember, like starch. So you know, you think, hey, let's go find a town in Alaska and film there. No. Let's go to New Zealand, build a town and cover it in fake snow.
It's probably cheaper than filming it here because of all different laws and unions and
that just seems so crazy that it would be cheaper to fly halfway around the world, build a town and cover it in fake snow than just, you know, go to Alaska or, you know, oh man, or Canada or something, you know. It's like
somewhere where there is snow.
Yeah. I mean, there's like a million towns, you know, but you know they want it to look a certain way, and that's commendable that they would go through that much trouble, but man, geez.
Seemed like it would take a lot of effort to keep it up from day to day, too.
Yeah. So. Yeah. They have to keep pouring it on and coating it to look right. You know, especially if you're, you know, we're talking about redoing scenes over and over. You know, that snow's going to move from them walking and whatever. They have to keep. Oh, that reminds me. The movie Halloween. Y'all seen that one, right? The scary movie?
Yes.
Well, they filmed it. I think they filmed it in California. And, but it was
supposed. No, I haven't seen that, but I know what you're talking about.
Okay. Okay. They filmed it, I believe, somewhere around California, but it was supposed to take place in Illinois or something during the fall with the fall leaves. But where they filmed it in California, it wasn't fall and there were no leaves. So they had to go and put like leaves on the grass. And they didn't have a lot of money. It was low budget. So whenever they moved to a new scene, they had to pick up all the leaves and reuse them and spread them out. You know, it's crazy. I love watching the commentary because stuff like that, you know, you just watch a movie and you're like, oh, you know. You know, it's fall or it's a town in Alaska. And then when you watch the commentary, you're like, man, they had to go through some enormous lengths of in trouble to like make it look like that. You know, you just don't know. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Pain in the butt.
There was another movie they were talking about it, and man, I don't remember what it was, but it was a movie that had something to do with water and ships or something. And so they built the sets inside of a building. Some huge warehouse somewhere, and so all the water scenes were done indoors in a building.
Wow.
It's just amazing the stuff that they can do. Of course, they can control the climate completely on what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, they're you know, the Forbidden Palace in China, the classic walled city, pretty much. There's a lot of movies that they film in the Forbidden Palace. However, the catch is. Hey, let me start over. Hey, guys. You know, there's a lot of movies that are filmed in a Forbidden Palace, but in reality, they recreated pretty much almost the entire Forbidden City in some, I don't know, region or whatever in China, almost down to the detail, at least the main parts of the giant massive courtyards, and that's where they film all these movies. So, you know, you see all these movies that take place there, but in reality, they're on a set, but the set is on such a massive scale that it's incredible that they would recreate it.
Is that the same place? I read an article where they built temples and whole cities and stuff from the different dynasties, and they're all it's all in one area, so you can go and film like the entire history of China in this one area. It's like that's what they built it for.
So they built it and they left it.
Yeah, they have like the old wooden palaces, and then they have like, you know, like Matthew said, the temple, you know, the Forbidden City, and they have like all these well known and you know, lesser known palaces and temples, and they rebuilt them all just for the purpose of making movies.
That'd be something neat to go see on a vacation.
Yeah, that would be. It'd be neat to.
Yeah, well, I think it's open for tourists. That's how they kind of make money in the off season.
They're like, get out of my movie. That'd be funny if they were filming something and you like kind of walked around the corner and you were like in the middle of some ninja battle or something and they didn't see
no
you.
One knows.
Yeah, and you were in the movie. It'd be like
what's
that.
Kind of interesting is like in Japan, again, this is just my observation, I could be wrong, but you know, they'll film commercials or they'll film stuff on the streets and whatnot. And it could be the case in China too, but I know in Japan, you know, you watch it and you're like, they didn't block off the streets. Because it's just such a busy city, they really can't.
Right.
So, you know, you're watching, and people in the back are, like, staring at the camera, like, what? But, you know, they just can't block off one of the busiest streets in Tokyo, so they film what they need to film. And everybody else just does their thing.
They just hope no one acts up in the background.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but people are obviously not acting like professional paid actors or what are they called? Not stand-ins. Extras?
Extras.
Yeah, they're not extras, you know. I mean, they're real people.
You know, you was talking about different things in movies. One that I remember, I don't know if y'all saw it or not. I'm thinking it was one of the Steve Martin movies where he's got a family or something. In the movie, there's a you can see a microphone hanging down from the top of him. And like they're in a house talking with his family, and there's a microphone at the top of the screen.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and this is a movie that you see in the theater. And I thought, well, you know, how in the world did they screw that up? You know, apparently, you know, they must have shot that scene once, maybe only one time, and it was a good take, and nobody noticed that the microphone was in the scene.
Wow.
And then it's the only one they have. I mean, because it's in the movie, it's something. There's like a couple of minutes of it in there.
Wow.
It has quite a... Go ahead.
Okay, I think what happens is, you know, as a director, you know, they watch it, but they watch it on an itty-bitty camera screen. And, you know, you take like 50 takes and you watch 50 takes through that little bitty, you know, 4x4 camera screen. And then at the end of the day, you know, you watch them again and dwindle it down. And then in editing, you watch it again. And it's just like reviewing a school paper or a presentation for work. You know, after the 10th time, you start just, you know, glossing over it. And you miss stuff. And then someone else comes along and right away is like, oh, yeah, that's misspelled.
Right, and that's true.
That's probably what happens there. Is all the people who are doing these editing have seen these scenes like 1,000 times, so they don't pick up on it. Because by the time it's on a big enough screen that you pick that error, they just don't see it.
Right.
The only thing I could figure out is that microphone must have been in every take, because surely they could have edited part of it out, but it must have been in.
You know, that could still be happening a lot today, but with their digital effects, they could go in and wipe it out. But back then, they couldn't. You know, after the fact, it was like, oh, okay, maybe no one will notice.
That's true. You can do things now. You couldn't do that.
Back to the 30 Days of Night. So it was supposed to be cold, you know, because it was Alaska. But since they were filming in wherever, New Zealand, and they had to make their own snow, it wasn't cold. So every time that people were outside. And, you know, when you breathe, you see the steam or the frost or whatever coming out of your mouth, like when you're breathing. They had to add that digitally throughout the entire movie because it wasn't cold. Yeah. So not only did they not film in real snow in a real town, they had to add that breathing effect throughout the entire movie.
And I wondered, did they film the film in New Zealand like, do they during their winter time? Otherwise, for the right effect outside, they'd have to be wearing heavy clothes with coats in Alaska, and they must have been hot.
Yeah, they'd be sweating, so they had to digitally take off the sweat.
I can't think of any other movies. I know there's got to be other things I've seen, like, you know, they start a scene and then they're supposed to be in the same scene a few seconds later, and they're wearing a different shirt or different coat or stain's not there or something like that.
Yeah, there was something, I can't remember if it was a MacGyver or what, but they flew in an airplane, and then when they, or maybe it was what you were telling me, Dad, they flew in an airplane, and then when they landed, it had a different number on it, like they switched planes.
Uh-huh.
You know,
I'll tell you one better. The first time I saw this was I remember watching some random 80s show. I was sitting in the kitchen bar watching from the black and white TV, you know, that hung down from the counter. This is in Indiana.
Okay.
And anyway, it was like, okay, well, you know, these three U.S. jets are en route and they're going to, you know, fire missiles at something because, I don't know, bad guys, I don't know, they got to stop the bad guys. And the good guy's trying to stop the bad guy before the military, three military jets blow up the vehicle. I don't know, whatever, right? Well, because it's just a TV show with limited budget, all their shots of the airplanes were, you know, I guess official or actual military footage or whatever. So every time they showed the planes, it was three different planes. Sometimes it was three F-16. Sometimes it was F-16 and F-8. You know, it was just obvious they weren't the same airplanes.
Right.
And you'll see that a lot in, like, if you watch, I don't know, like MacGyver or any of those shows where they're using stock footage, and so it's different aircraft.
Right, yeah, think it doesn't match up, or they use the exact same shot over and over. The plane's still coming. It's flying by that mountain again.
There was a sci-fi movie. I think it was the one of the ones that's been on TV show within the past month where they're, I think it's the one where there's some animal, octopus or shark or something in the water, and they got submarines and stuff from two different countries, and so one submarine, they show the picture of these guys standing in the submarine in amongst these control panels, and so they're standing in these 1950s. So this movie's supposed to be like today. These guys are standing inside the submarine in his control room. But it's these 1950 panels in like a powerhouse. They're all these aluminum panels. They got all these dials and knobs and stuff from the 1950s. And then they would talk to each other and they would point to the screen. And in this 1950s panel, it's supposed to be a flat LED screen with these graphics on it. You know, it made absolutely no sense. And then there was another ship where the guy was supposed to be standing on top of the ship, binoculars or something, looking at something. So he was standing on the ship, and behind him is a turbine generator from a power plant. It didn't even match. It was just so bad.
That was Mega Shark versus Giant Squid or Giant Octopus or something.
What do you expect?
The opening scene is they're in a submarine, and it's what's her name? Tiffany or one of those singer girls from the '80s. She's behind the screen, and she's typing, and the close up of the fingers typing has black fingernail polish, and then when they cut to her talking, her fingernails aren't painted. And that's the opening scene.
And it's like, sometimes though they mean to do that.
No. I mean,
you don't think so?
I don't know, because that's like so obvious, because they kept showing, because it's so cheap, you know, they keep showing close-ups of everything. They kept showing these fingers typing, and she's talking, and it has her voiceover. And then the next scene when she's standing there talking, and she's talking with her hands, there's no fingernail polish. And, you know, it's like, that's how they're going to start it.
It only went down from there.
You know, that's the kind of stuff they used to do way back in those cheap, crappy 80s movies where, like, it's in the future, and it's a sci-fi spaceship, but it's in a power plant.
Exactly.
You know, and it's like, this is 2009. But that's interesting that you picked up the turbine thing, you know, because, you know, I guess a lot of people might not pick up on it, so they thought they could get away with it, you know?
Yeah.
That kind of looks like a submarine.
Sets that are awesome. Some people cry about how, you know, back in the golden age of Hollywood, sets were incredible. You know, Ben-Hur, Spartacus, you know, they made all these full sets, and nowadays you really don't see it that much just because everything's so expensive. And this was, again, before CG. But, you know, then you look at other movies, like look at Under Siege, you know, I mean, indisputably one of the greatest movies ever. And they pretty much did they... I was going to say, I think they rebuilt the whole battleship, but I don't think they... Never mind.
They did that for Titanic. They built a whole bunch of different size models and stuff, and like in a huge tank and everything, you know. And that was, what, 97 or something? Also had Temple of Doom on the other night, and I was watching one of the little featurettes. And real quick, they were showing different scenes from the movie. And at the end where Indy and Molaram are fighting on the bridge... And they're hanging from that cliff. They built that cliff. There's a real cliff that they filmed on. But then for the scene where they're hanging from the bridge that's been snapped and it's, you know, leaning against the cliff face, they built a huge cliff on a scaffolding. It just showed like a scene, like a photo of it. And while they were talking about something, I'm like, holy crap, they built that cliff. I guess they couldn't really do it, you know, film it on location, so they did the big shots, and then for the close-ups of them fighting on that bridge, they built one to match it, and like, dang.
That would be interesting to go back and watch that part of the movie, not the whole movie, but just that part, to see if when they shot the film from a distance, did they build the wall, the cliff wall, accurately? Tell that they match.
That would be interesting. One of the neat things that I really like is when they used to do matte paintings, and they would paint part of a background, and they would leave part of it open so the film would show through. It's really neat to go back and watch these movies. You know, they don't do it anymore, I don't think, but you can go back and watch the behind the scenes and see the matte paintings or in some of like the making of books. And some of the matte paintings, you didn't even know they were there. It's just so perfect.
Yeah, Indiana Jones and Indiana Jones Ark of the Covenant?
Raiders of the Lost Ark?
Yeah, jeez. Anyway, that scene at the end, you can hardly tell. You know, when they're in the warehouse.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that they did this, man, until one of the movies that came out years ago, I'm thinking the name of it was called Earthquake, it was one of the movies where they had the special effects, where they had all the sound rumbling. One of the first movies where you could actually feel they shook the theater. If the theater had the right speakers, it would shake the whole theater.
Oh, wow.
the realistic experience with the speakers. And that was the one where I was watching a thing about it where they did, they shot the scene, and then I guess what I thought they did was they took pictures, and then they actually cut pieces out of the picture, and then they filmed it on top of it, showing the water going places.
Oh, maybe okay.
That's the same as a matte painting. I don't know.
Some of the matte paintings, what they'll do is say, I know there's one in Indiana Jones where he's at the end. They're walking over a hill and kind of down a hill to a village. Well, the hill he walks over and down was filmed like in California or whatever. And at a certain point, like where the hill, the bottom of the hill, the rest of it's a matte painting of a village, and they merged it. So like, you know, he's walking down that hill and that's real. But then they painted over, you know, what's really there in real life. So you couldn't even tell. So I guess that what you're talking about would be the same thing, except instead of a painting, they have a photo and they cut out where the film shows through or however that works.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nowadays, they just do it with computer graphics, like you said.
Yeah, matte painting's awesome. I'll have to show you. I have a book that has a bunch of special effects from like the first 10 movies that ILM helped do the special effects for, and they show like a lot of that, the matte paintings and stuff, and how they'll, like the Ewok village was a matte painting, but they left little holes for fire, so they filmed real fire, but it's like over the matte painting or whatever, and man, it's awesome stuff. See, we talked about Captain EO, we talked about making movies, I mean, we could talk about that forever. Okay, well, anything else before we sign off? Okay, well, thanks everyone for listening. You can email me at christophertupa@hotmail.com. And check out the website at ctupa.com. Okay, so here at TupaCast, we're going to start a contest. I spend a lot of time and quarters on the machines that are at grocery stores and others. Used to be at Walmart, but not anymore. But anyway, so I have a huge collection of 25-cent, 50-cent little toys and junk things. So what I'm going to do is if you write in and give us a topic that we use on a podcast, I will mail you a random little, I don't even know what you call these things, little toys. Stuff's pretty cool. I don't buy this stupid stuff. But so if you send us a topic and we use it, you'll have to give me your address, of course, and I will mail you a little toy. So there you go. TupaCast contest number one. Okay.
Can I enter?
No. Yeah, I'm gonna have to start sneaking stuff out of Ariana's room to mail people. Okay, well, I guess that's it then.
Okay.
All right, good night.
All right, good night.